You're very welcome to the programme. Where we are, it's not 3 minutes past 10, as it normally is. It's actually 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, and we're here at 13 Berkeley Street on Dublin City's north side. It's home to one of the outreach services provided by the Peter McVerry Trust. It tries to help young men who are homeless and addicted to drugs. Well, as you can hear, there's a party going on at the moment, celebrating Christmas, and the place is packed. There's toys for the children, hampers for the families, and hats, scarves and gloves being given out. We'll hear from Peter McVerry himself in a minute, and we have a panel of guests to discuss drug addiction and homelessness in this country. And we'll hear how those on the margins are spending this Christmas. First, though, I went along to the Peter McVerry headquarters, which isn't far from here. It's on Sherard Street, yesterday afternoon, where staff, including Anne, were sorting through some of the donations which had just been left in.
This has been handed in. We got plenty of trainers handed in yesterday as well, so the guys have gone through them. And a lot of secondhand clothes are handed in, but nothing brand new yet. But loads of lovely runners. These are, let me see, little farm animals here, farm sets here, and basically most of the participants here have children, so that's why we're going to be giving those out. And then it's like colouring sets here, the different ones in white and pink, so... they're all that's what came in today. So.
Do you have many to give to?
Oh yeah, loads. I mean, we would get like 40, 50 to the day into this service. This is the Streets to Home service. So yes, we would have a lot, and most of the participants have children, beat a few. So yes, these will fly out, which is great because it'll help a lot of people out now. We've limited space, unfortunately. So I'm going to try and get these out as quickly as possible to participants so then I can kind of get the office back to normal. These people here don't have any excess money, so it's whatever they get, they're living on a day-to-day basis. So this is a huge help. I mean, you saw some of the guys there, they're related. Like, this is a huge help. You know, we're open till Christmas Eve, so hopefully more stuff will come in. And tomorrow we're doing a big feed as well. We're doing a big spread up in Berkeley Street. So it's for all the different services with the Trust, so that'll be lovely. And we do give out gifts then, like hats, scarves, gloves. We do hampers as well, you know, be it tins, sweets, coffee, tea, so that'll be a huge help to people as well. Yeah, so it is, it's great.
Well, when I was there, one of the people who dropped into Sherard Street yesterday afternoon was John. He's recently out of prison and he's trying to get his life back on track after a serious heroin addiction, but he's not finding things easy and he's not looking forward to Christmas.
I'm only released from prison. And I'm had been in now jail for the past 10 years. I've been out a day here, a day there. And with the tablets and the heroin, they don't mix. I end up back up in prison. So I'm just a bit psyched. And this year, I'm trying to get myself a place. Father McFerry's been very helpful. He's got me runners. He's looked after me. He's got me a jacket. He's got me pillows for my nieces and nephews.
Where do you sleep at night?
Oh, yeah, me, I'm sleeping at different locations. I'm sleeping in Cedar House. Some nights I'm staying in the streets. I take it day by day, because that's the only way I could take it. And Christmas, it looks very bleak for me. In prison, yeah, Christmas isn't bleak, really. The only thing you're missing is drugs and your woman. Everything else is handed to you on the plate.
How will you spend Christmas this year?
Do you want the really honest answer to that? I know I'm going to be very depressed. And I think I'll spend the Christmas because I've no home and I've no nothing. Stoned. That is the honest answer.
To forget about it?
To forget about the depression at the Dublin streets. The little bit of light that I do get is from this place, from Peter McFerry, his helping hand.
You have a child, don't you?
I have a 14-year-old young lady. I don't get to see him much because of my drug habit. I don't blame her for that because she was 100% right to do what she did because she didn't want anything like that around my son. And I'd like to wish him a Merry Christmas. And I'm sorry. And there's not many sorries I can make up. And it eats at me every day of the year. His birthday does be on the 8th of March and it eats at me.
Will you even see him over Christmas?
No, I will not see him over Christmas. How could I see my son? If I had my own place, that'd be a different story. But there's nothing there in place for people like me.
So what about the months ahead then? We're coming into a new year. Mm. Do you think anything is going to change in your life?
I think no. Nothing's going to change. I know everybody says, why don't you just grow up off your backside and do something yourself and get a job? To tell you the truth, that's the first time I've looked for a walk in ages. I was out there during the week looking for a kitchen porter. And I went into every place and I sent in loads of CVs and I didn't get one reply.
And what are you still on?
At the moment, I'm not taking heroin. At the moment, I'm just taking 30 mils of methadone. I was down to 10 mils when I got out of prison. I was smoking 3 roll-ups a day. Yeah, stress-free. When I got out with all the stress, I'm taking the volume, a lot of volume. And you can hear it in my voice.
What's life like on the streets?
I can't really explain it yet. You have to experience it yourself. It's just no place. It's no place. You just love to be at home with your family for Christmas, wouldn't you? Just the warmth of your family. Just before you go to bed, the night before Christmas Eve, sipping on a glass of cognac or a glass of whiskey, and just think, some poor beggar sleeping on the cold hair ground.
And that was John with his story about how he'll be spending Christmas. A pretty bleak story there. Well, with me here at Berkeley Street in North Dublin are Peter McVerry, who runs these centres. I'm also joined by Tony Gagan from Merchants Quay Ireland, which has been providing services for drug users for the past 20 years. And Ciara Conway is a Labour TD. Peter, I'll start with you and talk to you for a couple of minutes first, because this is your centre. We were in Sherrard Street yesterday. You've been doing this a long, long time. Can you remember what sparked you to do it in the first place?
Yeah, it was very simple. I was working in the inner city at the time. We weren't working with young people, but not homeless people. Came across a 9-year-old kid sleeping on the street. So we decided we had to open a small little hostel for him and a few others like him. And I thought no more of it. We were running other services for homeless, for young people, such as a youth club and a craft centre and employment schemes. So we just added a hostel to it. And then the numbers grew and grew, and the kids in the hostel got older and older, and we needed to get another place for them as they got older. And it just snowballed after that. So we ended up opening a variety of different hostels for different age groups. Then the drug problem came. We had to start opening drug treatment programs. So one thing just led to another.
Would you have any idea at this point of how many young men you've helped?
No idea. I mean, over 30 years, you're certainly talking of a few thousand, at least. Some of them would have remained very much in touch with us and very close to us. Others would have come in for a period of time and disappeared again.
And Tony Gagan, Peter mentioned there, then the drugs came into it. Mm. That's an intrinsic part of this problem, isn't it? The drug addiction.
Well, obviously, yeah, drugs and homelessness have become hugely enmeshed in the last decade. Prior to homelessness, they tended to be more separate. And in fact, the whole drug scene has changed hugely over the last 20 years. Well, originally, when Peter mentioned the drugs came, it was an opiate epidemic that was right across Europe, same in Britain, all European countries. But now we find that the trends have changed again, and there's a much greater diversification of drug use. I know in the clip that was played, and you heard a young man talking about using Valium, and they are so prolific on the street now that they are by far and away the most popular drug. And the difficulty, of course, with those type of drugs is that they're huge disinhibitors as well. So people really often really don't know what they're doing, you know, or what they're saying half the time when they're on those drugs, and consequently get into all sorts of problems individually for their families in the local communities that they're in. And the response, the state response to that has been very, very poor and still remains very poor. You know, for an estimated minimum 20,000 opiate users in the country now, and who would all be polydrug users using other drugs, we still only have about 40 dedicated detox beds for that number of drug users, which, you know, if it was in some other area, there'd be huge hue and cry about it. And I think that's what I personally find so frustrating, that we get so much people giving out about the drug problem and about the homeless problem and people on the streets and people on the boardwalk. But if we're that concerned about it and jumping up and down that much about it, why don't we do something about it? You know, and that's what I find hugely frustrating.
Yeah, interesting. Far more people die of drugs and drug-related illnesses than die in road traffic accidents.
That's correct, yeah.
And yet we have all this huge emphasis, and rightly so, on safety in road traffic, but nothing about drugs.
It's a good point to bring in Ciara Conway, Labour TD. Ciara, you've heard John's story as well. You've heard what Tony and Peter have had to say. Are these people forgotten about by the people in Leinster House, by the political classes?
I mean, I think when you hear his story, you could say maybe they are. I mean, you know, politicians are not all the same, and political establishments are not all the same. They have changed. But I think over the years, prior to my election to the Dáil, I was a social worker, worked firsthand with people coming in and out of the care system, coming in and out of the jail system. And I've seen and know and understand that often, you know, at the back, at the root, deep down, when these children were very young, often goes down to family breakup and poor relationships, not only within their family, but also within their community. And I think there has been a failure of the state to intervene in a way that's meaningful for that child as a young person, meaningful for the parents. But I think things are beginning to change. Now, we have two problems. I think what Tony says is absolutely correct, that there is a problem in terms of beds to try and detox people when they want the help. There's no doubt about that. So we have two problems in that there's the immediate problem of the people who are experiencing the homelessness and the drug problem. But I think there's another issue about we need to start thinking differently about how we work with communities, particularly disadvantaged communities. And I think some of the things that we've done recently, very recently, in terms of the area-based approaches to child poverty, I think are very welcome. And I think it's probably something that Peter and Tony would have advocated for over the years. I know it's something that I would have advocated for when I was on the other side of the gate in Leinster House, or in Kildare Street, I should say. And I'm very proud to be trying to do that. But I do agree that there is a problem in terms of resource allocation to dealing with the immediate problem of people who are faced with the crisis of drugs and homelessness today.
What's your solution, Peter?
The solution to homelessness is, first of all, to give homeless people a legal right to a place called home, just as we did with children in the 1991 Child Care Act. And as a result of that, services for homeless children have improved enormously. They're still not perfect, but they have improved. I think until we give people a right to a home, we will never solve the homeless problem. And then in practical way, what we have to do is invest heavily now in social housing. There's been a huge reduction in the provision of social housing, and that started even during the Celtic Tiger years when we had the money.
And we're going to talk more about housing in the second half, but in terms of drug addiction, what's your policy?
In 2005, in the midterm review of the previous National Drug Strategy, recommendation was that everybody should have access to treatment within 4 weeks of being assessed. That's in 2005. We still aren't anywhere near that. There's certain parts of the country where you will get where that happens, but that's because there's no services and no assessment. But there are waiting lists in some parts of the country of 12 months, or even in one case, 3 years to get into a drug treatment program. The social and economic benefits of providing drug treatment on demand are obvious to everybody. But if somebody's on heroin and has to wait 12 months to get onto a methadone program, they're going to commit on average 2 crimes a day to feed their heroin habit. That's 700 crimes going to be committed simply because we didn't have a place for them on a detox program.
So it's a resource issue, Tony.
It is. And I think, you know, I do want to recognise what the government have done, but having said that, I think the government made the first step back in the Rabbit report, and I go back to Labour, when they brought out that report, and it did open up access to treatment. But nothing has happened much since then. We currently have about 10,000 people on methadone. Up to half of those have been on it for over 10 years. You know? So we park people on methadone and don't put the resources in to provide pathways out of that for people, to resource people, you know, to be able to fulfill their own potential, you know, for independent living, you know, to get their first foot up on the ladder. They're parked on methadone. And I believe that's a disgrace that we have, you know, people, over maybe 5,000 people on methadone over 10 years. Now, I understand some people may need to be on methadone for the rest of their lives, and if that's so, well and good. But many, many people will take off if they get the resource, they get some skills training, to get education, to get the psychological support that they need. They can, and I know loads of people, and I'm sure Peter does as well, who've come through our services and are flying back out there, and come back and support our services. And back to the resource, it is like, of the 40 detox beds that are available, we provide 10 of them down in St. Francis Farm, medically supervised beds. We fund that primarily from voluntary donations. The state fund 4 beds out of the 10 dedicated detox beds that we provide. The rest are provided by the general public. And again, that's an indictment on the state as well and on their commitment to providing pathways for people.
Ciara, what do you say to that? It does all come back to commitment, and is the methadone programme, is that the start and the end of government policy in relation to this?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously before I came here today I did a little bit of research on it, and there's 4 levels in terms of engaging with people, in terms
of the four-tier model,
right? So one is in relation to the beds, 2 is in relation to, drop-in services in terms of, needle exchange,
sure,
and that kind of thing.
Community detox.
3 then we have in relation to primary care, assessing people. And 4 then is engaging with families and, having the local drugs task force been able to react to the problem as it transpires in the community. I mean, there was a lot of, concern about the budget in relation to the drugs task forces. And in fairness to Alex White, he had a battle royale on his hands to try and protect the funding that we have. And I think instead of a 7% reduction, we have a 3% reduction. And I know it's kind of like welcoming bad news, but could have been worse, But I think you're right. I think, methadone isn't a solution, and leaving people languishing on it is not a solution either. I know, just in Waterford lately, I visited a primary care centre, and there is an addiction counsellor now as part of that team. So I think, we're moving in the right direction, but it's a very small drop in the ocean, I'll grant you that. But what I will say in relation to the drugs task force and what's happened there, what I think is very significant from my own experience of working with people who struggle with difficulties, is that alcohol is now included as part of the national drug strategy. I think for a long number of years that has been absent. And I've often said that the headlines often go, and I know in Dublin, and we're here in the inner city in Dublin today, where heroin and opiates have taken grip of communities, hasn't been the experience right across the country. But what has been experienced by communities, by families, and particularly by children, has been the misuse of alcohol. Like the report that Geoffrey Shannon did lately in relation to, he's the Special Rapporteur in Child Protection, he reviewed all the cases in the child death inquiries. Alcohol was a risk factor in every single one of those cases. And the second thing to say is that what Geoffrey Shannon called for, the only thing he called for in his last report was to ensure that alcohol sponsorship was banned from sports. And I agree with him.
But that's not happening. Tony Gagan, you wanted
in. I wanted to respond quickly. One on the Dublin focus thing, that say if you take our detox or rehab unit, which is in on the Wexford Carlow border, a farm there, when we opened that first back in 98, it was primarily Dublin people. Now Dublin people are in the minority. In the last year, we've seen people from 15 different counties have accessed our detox program there, So that's an indication of how much, the drug issue has spread around the country. In relation to alcohol, all of services like ourselves and like Peter's and like, all the other voluntary would already be dealing with alcohol. But what's significant is there's been no budget transfer in terms of the drug strategy. The budget has been reduced by 3% from last year. There's been no additional resources put in, although we provide alcohol detox in our detox unit. Most drug users are using alcohol, and we see primary alcohol users as well, but there's been no budget transfer to support that. So I think it has been slightly disingenuous, to say that the drug and alcohol strategy have come together and now it's a unified strategy. And I know Alex White has done a lot of work around advertising and, around the prevention issue around alcohol, which is as it should be, but they haven't resourced the treatment sector, to deal with the additional numbers that are coming into it,
Peter, on this programme a few weeks ago, we debated legalisation or not of drugs, and you advocate the legalisation of all drugs. Just to explain again how you believe that would help, because we heard from John there, he's on methadone, he's in and out of prison all the time. Would legalising all drugs break that cycle of drugs, prison, drugs?
Well, first of all, the bottom line is that the drug strategy simply isn't working. We got to take our heads out of the sand. As Tony says, more and more drugs are spreading all around the country. So it's just not working. So we have to start looking at alternative ways of dealing with the drug problem. I think legalising drugs would do a number of things. It would cut the market from under the criminal gangs, first of all. And that's a huge problem in communities, particularly deprived communities, where violence against drug users who owe money and violence against their families is huge. It's causing, I know at least one person who's committed suicide, one young person, because they owed money to a drug dealer. So it would do that. It would also mean that it would obviously be controlled. And the model I would use is methadone. Methadone is a highly dangerous drug. More people die from methadone than from heroin. It's a more addictive than heroin. And yet it's given out free of charge by the state, basically to anybody who wants it. And now it's much more difficult to get methadone on the black market than it is to get heroin. But you know exactly what you're getting, so there's no health problems associated with the drug that you're taking. And you're taking the drug, if you legalise drugs, you're taking the drug in an environment where you're in contact with professional people and counsellors and all that. And so you're more likely to be encouraged and moved in the direction of coming off drugs. So I think there's a huge discussion has to take place. There are different models of legalising drugs, but I really do think that is one model that we seriously have to look at, because what we're doing now just simply isn't working.
In a recent Dáil debate, Ciara Conway, I mean, this was debated and voted on the back of a Luke Ming Flanagan proposal, but the government, you know, voted against it. It's not going to happen, is it? There's not even going to be a proper discussion about it.
I don't know if there won't be a proper discussion about it. I think lots of discussions happen in Leinster House, but whether it'll be enacted or not is another thing. I mean, my own personal opinion would be that I would agree with the lion's share of what Peter McVerry has spoken about there, particularly in relation to the kind of threatening behaviour and the economy that grows up around drugs in local communities and what it puts on it. I think, you know, Deputy Flanagan's bill wasn't all that maybe we would have wished for. But I think, you know, it gave people the opportunity to discuss the issue and to air it, because for a long number of years, like, be it in relation to methadone or be it in relation to you know, access to detox beds, these issues are not always on the political radar. They're not up there with the priority, and I'd be the first to say that. And it takes people you know, who have the interest in the area, who want to see improvements, to take the opportunity to do that. I mean, I know I would say though as well, in relation to, you know, looking at the whole issue of disadvantage, looking at the whole issue of, because it often goes hand in hand in relation to homelessness and drug abuse, and not always, but often, if we're to be really radical about what we're going to do, it can be difficult to convince the public and to convince the people in Leinster House that we're going to take a whole bunch of money and invest it in children at 3 and 4 years of age, and we won't see the return until they're 18 or 19. Now, I believe in that model very strongly, but it can be difficult to do it. But I think that conversation is beginning to happen, and we're beginning to see some changes in how people are approaching it. But again, I go back to the issue. We've two problems. We have the emerging issue and the persisting issue in communities, and we have people who are here now desperate for a home and desperate for services. So it is very difficult, and I would never shy away from that.
Tony, where do you stand on the legalisation of all drugs?
Well, I think legalisation is probably a bit of a quantum leap for us, but I certainly would advocate decriminalisation. Yeah. I find it totally crazy that Ireland is one of the few jurisdictions where we don't have a Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, which runs totally contrary to the whole notion that prison and incarceration is supposed to be about rehabilitation. But if people have a conviction, then it mitigates against them in terms of employment, in terms of travel, in terms of reintegration into society in general. So people can be criminalised, you know, for the possession of cannabis, for possession of any drug. And really, so that's the first step that I would take, would be to remove it out of the criminal justice system. And I think that would go a long way to addressing some of the issues for people, you know. So I think that, you know, on the wider legalization, I think some countries have taken different models. The Portuguese model seems to be a good model. Uruguay have now started a new model as well. So I think, you know, certainly I'm interested in those things, and I accept what Peter says to try and take it out of the hands of criminals. But I think the pertinent one for us right here and now is that, you know, we continue to criminalize people, you know, for their personal drug use. And really, that is so wasteful in terms of state resources, you know, courts times, guardies times, you know, prisons, all of those costs that could be used much more effectively in other spheres. You know.
And Tony, we've heard, sorry, Peter, you wanted to.
It is ironic now that we have an alcohol and drug strategy, but our approach to alcohol is totally different to our approach to drugs. If somebody has an alcohol problem, we don't call the police. We call social workers, we call medical people, and we get them into treatment. If somebody has a drug problem and they have drugs on them, we call the police. I think we need to treat all drugs as a socio-medical problem, not as a criminal justice problem. And as Tony says, that'll save the state an awful lot of money.
Just going back to your point there in relation to alcohol, I think you're right. You know, it does, when things get chronically out of control, people do often, you know, refer to social workers or whatever. But what concerns me most is that it wasn't acknowledged and acted on in all those child death inquiries. It wasn't engaged with by the social workers in a way that it should have been. Our approach and our attitude to alcohol culturally, I think, is something that we need to look at and to renegotiate with the people working on the front line. Because I am concerned that people almost turn a blind eye, and yet we know for a fact that alcohol has been a significant risk factor in all those child death inquiries that we've had.
Okay, well, look, Tony, you're leaving us at this point. We thank you very much indeed and wish you a very happy Christmas. We're going to spend the rest of the programme talking about homelessness. It's another, obviously, the Peter McVerry Trust, that is their main focus as well. We're going to hear now from another man who has received a lot of help from the Peter McVerry Trust. When I went to Sherard Street yesterday afternoon, I met Robert, who has been homeless for at least 20 years, and he told me where he would be spending Christmas.
Well, we spend it in the hostel that I live in.
How long have you lived there?
Over two years, but I'm in a hostel well over 20 years.
How did that happen?
It just happened. I was young, as stuff happened. I don't really think of how I end up homeless.
And what's the hostel like?
It's really good. It's really good. They look after you, and they have different key workers to make sure that your needs are met.
And how would you describe your life at the minute? I mean, how bad did it get and how different is it now?
My life is actually a hell of a lot better than what it was. A hell of a lot better. The help was always there, you see. It was age that helped me avail of the help properly. It would have been a lot to do with the stint on the streets. It was a good couple of years on the streets, on and off, and in horrible situations. I got attacked one time on the streets, and like, with these two lads, and they were drunk, and like, they were older men, like, and I was just a kid, and they hit me, and I just didn't really know what was happening, and I just, you know. But it sort of affected me through different things in my life, like, you know, my confidence and stuff like that. I failed to trust people, and I think that was the major issue. I failed to trust people because these things happened on the streets. And there was very limited places that I could go to, you know, and they were doing the best. And I was a chap that sort of, I needed to be reached out and just to be let know that you're safe, you're going to be okay. And I had a family that cared about me a lot and you know, were searching for me all the time that I was homeless, and the time I didn't know. I remember a lot of times what used to hurt me, and especially in the summertime, you'd see people leaving their children to school, and you're out there just leaving a sleeping bag in the doorway early because the shop would be open fairly soon after. And you just wish that you were part of that. You'd wish that you were part of that rat race and say, hey, you know, I want to be. I wish that I was going to work. I wish I was leaving my kids to school, or, you know. I met a lot of really good, close, warm people on the streets. People I'll probably never meet again. I'd have an intellectual conversation and you'd be thinking to yourself, hey, who's that person homeless? You'd see who'd look in the doorway together for the whole night, which is very important, and then they're gone. And then to find out that people that you spent time on the streets with, like, ended up dying. A lot of people turn to drugs and drink because they can't handle the fact of being out on their own, and I did turn to drinking drugs myself because of that. It's a very lonely thing to be on your own on the streets, thinking that nobody cares about you.
Have you reached out to your family in the last number of years?
My family, and only for Peter McFerry. If it wasn't for Peter McFerry, I wouldn't have been in touch with my family. But there's lots of times that my family have reached out and came out of the blue and took me off the streets. But my addiction, because it manifested and into something that was like a second personality, and then turned into something sort of really, you know, that you wouldn't really want around, you know, a home that was, you know, wanted serene and to be okay. So that sort of messed me up. And my family did come and find me, they changed me, they washed me, and then because of my addiction and because of my behaviour, they couldn't handle me or keep me around. And I understood I was acting the way I was because of drugs at the time. Before the drugs we even got involved, I didn't understand why I was the way I was. And that was a behavioural issue that just wasn't diagnosed back at a certain time. And
do you see things changing for you?
I'm in a good position, and it took me a long, long time to get into that position. It wasn't overnight. But that's the way that this homeless thing is. There's places for people, and then there's not enough places. And then you have people that have different mental issues, emotional issues, that, you know, need to be looked after. And you know, and to mix them in with other personalities that, you know, don't have that going on for themselves, that can be catastrophic for the young child that they're going into that, and which results in many deaths and suicide. And if you look back in the 90s, the rise of suicide in this country was phenomenal.
Do you like Christmas?
Yeah, I really do like Christmas. I'd like it to be a little bit better, but I'm sure that you see that. See, that's a question for everybody, not just for somebody that's homeless. You know, that's a question for the child in each and every one of us. That's the borderline part between magic and when you grow up. Hope, really. Let's face it. That's basically what it is, and fate. And fate is the substance that things hoped for. It's about belief. It's about that little bit of magic that can't be touched by the real world.
And that was Robert there with his story. Well, joining me now for this part of the discussion is Dr. Paula Mayock from the Children's Research Centre at Trinity College here in Dublin. And she has done a lot of work on youth homelessness. Still here, Peter McFerry and Labour TD Ciara Conway. Peter, another person who has devoted her life to combating homelessness is Alice Leahy of Trust. And she says homelessness in this city specifically is the worst that she has seen in 40 years. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I have no hesitation in saying that. I have never seen it so bad. The potential for getting out of homelessness, the doors out of homelessness have been closed effectively. The frustration level of homeless people is rising, and my own frustration level is rising, because increasingly people are coming into me and I'm ending up saying, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. There isn't anywhere for you to go. So yeah, I absolutely agree. And over 35, I've never seen it as bad as it is at the moment.
Can you explain why?
I don't know. I presume it's to do with the recession. I think people are losing their private rented accommodation because the demand for renting is going up, and therefore the cost of renting is going up. And I do know some people, the landlord has simply added on an extra couple of hundred euros per month to their rent. And the rent supplement has been going down the other direction, and they simply can't afford it. As well as that, I suspect that the financial stresses on families and on relationships is causing difficulties and breakup of relationships. So if I'm sharing accommodation, say with a partner or with my parents or with friends, and my relationship with them breaks down, then I leave. And if I have no money, then I become homeless. So I think the financial pressures are resulting in relationship pressures, which are resulting in breakup and homelessness.
Paula Mayock, Paula, you have studied this. You've done a lot of research on this during your career as an academic. What is the age profile of the average homeless person? Is it mostly young people or older people?
a large proportion are young people under the age of 25 years. Of course, homelessness is notoriously difficult to enumerate, but our best estimates would suggest that up to 25 or 30% to one third are certainly under the age of 30. So it is a very significant proportion of the overall homeless population. I suppose one issue that might be useful to clarify here, or to make a distinction between the under 18s and the over 18s, we have in fact seen some quite dramatic improvements in the situations of homeless children. We have now far fewer homeless children than we did 10 years ago. The youth homeless strategy was recently reviewed and was judged to have positively contributed to resolving homelessness for the under 18s. And this is significant because in fact that strategy was essentially written for the under 18s, albeit that it's called the Youth Homelessness Strategy 2001. Where we have a very significant problem is when young people reach the age of 18, they have no longer a statutory entitlement to a whole range of services, so all of these wraparound, I suppose, cushions are immediately removed and they are literally left without support. This is when we see, and in fact from talking to young people over the years and the various research projects I've conducted, young people will typically depict that as a major crisis point in their lives when they are hugely aware of entering the world and the realms of the adult homeless. Into adult homeless hostels, in many cases, these settings are extremely inappropriate for young people. They're frightening environments, environments where young people have a huge amount to lose personally and socially. At this point as well, they actually begin to see themselves as homeless probably for the first time. So we have this real disconnect between two services, and almost guided by some kind of assumption that when somebody is 18, they can suddenly fend for themselves, where in fact our most advantaged young people going to college, etc., are not expected to do that.
What do you say to that, Ciara Conway? Because the youth strategy may have worked, but as Paula was saying to us earlier, there was no definition of youth, so it was assumed it was 18 and under. But again, the over 18s are just left.
Yeah, no, I think there is a difficulty there, and I understand that the Minister is, Minister Francis Fitzgerald is going to have an amendment in the Childcare Act in relation to the provision of aftercare, which is something that, you know, both my colleagues here would, you know, have campaigned, I'm sure, over the years, because in the legislation currently it talks about may provide aftercare as opposed to shall, and you know that changing of that one word will have on the statutory footing, the state will be obliged to plan and look after children once they reach the age of 18, and I think that is going to be very significant. Now there is an issue and a drive within us and as backbenchers to ensure that there's a budget for that as well. That's very, very important. But I mean, like, you know, listening to that tape earlier of that young man, he spoke about being a young man and being afraid and being on the street, and that he was beaten up randomly one night by two adults. And I just think, if people think about, like, I have a little brother who's 16, I have a little brother who's 19, like, first of all, to think of him on the street on his own, and then second of all, to see two adult men come over and beat them up. Like, these are people with families, and for whatever reason, they've ended up on the street. And I think that the state has a responsibility to ensure that transition from childhood into very early adulthood is given those wraparound services, that they are not pulled away like a band-aid, you know, on their 18th birthday. And I've seen that, you know, I mean, I'm not oblivious to the difficulty that's there. I'm not denying it. I've seen it firsthand, being in case conferences with children that I've worked with, and trying to fight for resources to ensure that they have somewhere to sleep, that they have a training opportunity or an education opportunity. And what can be very difficult is that when the child, maybe who's in care, who's 18 and is doing very well in school, they're often looked after because, you know, maybe the foster family are, you know, going to hold on to them. But it's the children who are difficult, the children who their foster placements break down, or they're not even in foster care, they're in supportive lodgings or something like that. They don't have any of those supports. So you're talking about 15, 16, 17 year old children without any of those supports. And I think it's incumbent upon us to ensure on the 1st of January, when we have the Child and Family Agency established, that those kind of resources are in place for our young people for 18, because I'm sure, you know, the panel here would agree that it's also not just a crisis in terms of what their life is going to be, but it's a risk factor in terms of their longevity. you know, because it's often a time when we see attempted suicide. It's often a time when we see, you know, people maybe engaging in risky behaviour because they're trying to get away from the reality of their life, you know.
Does that give you any hope, Peter, about what's coming in January?
Oh, I never believe anything that's coming till I see it. I've been disappointed too often with promises, and so no, I'll wait till I see it. But Claire is perfectly correct. We spend a child in residential care. We spend a minimum of 100,000 euros per year on that child. So over a 6-year period in a residential home, you're spending over 600,000 on that child. If they're simply dumped into adult homelessness, we've wasted that money, because their life is just going to go downhill very rapidly. And it's that age group, the 18 to 25, is so critical, because even after a few weeks homeless, your self-esteem hits rock bottom. And it becomes very difficult then to motivate you to do something to try and get out of homelessness. So the important thing is catching young people as early as possible when they become homeless, and lifting them out of that homelessness, ideally within weeks of encountering homelessness.
Paula, there is a view out there that homelessness is a lifestyle choice for many people. I mean, what do you say to that?
It's a complete stereotype and absolutely not true. There may be a handful of people who choose homelessness for a short period. But homelessness is the result, for young people, is primarily the result of problems in the family. There is a common perception that homelessness is caused by drug use. Yes, some homeless people have drug problems, alcohol problems, but in fact, again, our research would indicate that their reason for becoming homeless was not linked with drug use, but once they became homeless, they were far more likely to engage in problematic drug use. In fact, a lot of the young people were introduced to heroin within the hostel system, within street-based contexts, when sleeping rough, squatting. So what homelessness in effect does, it exacerbates drug problems, unsurprisingly. But there is, as I say, a common perception that in all cases, homelessness, or in a majority of cases, homelessness is caused by drug use. And this is, in fact, not the case, certainly for young people.
And Peter, you want to challenge that view as well, that all homeless people are drug addicts?
Absolutely. The vast majority of homeless people do not have an addiction of any sort. They are simply people who have lost their accommodation, people who have broken up relationships, people who have no more problems than anybody else, except they don't have the money to go out and be able to pay for their own accommodation. As Paula says, homelessness, I would say, is a choice. But it's a choice other people make for homeless people. In other words, politicians, because there aren't enough beds, there aren't enough places for people to, and there isn't enough help to get out of homelessness. So people remain in homelessness because other people, politicians, have chosen not to resource the alternatives. If some people choose to live on the streets, and I think a few do, it's because the alternative is worse. Going into a drug-infested hostel full of people who you don't know. I have young people going in and they tell me they leave within an hour. They're frightened to death going into a dormitory full of strangers that they don't know, some of whom are using drugs in the middle of the night, and who may be intimidating them, bullying them and terrifying them. People who are abused as children, and that's a lot of homeless people, tell me they break out in sweats at the thought of sleeping in a dormitory full of strangers. So sleeping on the streets for some people seems to be the safest and happiest option, and that's an indictment on our political system.
I think that Robert's story there suggests that. He slept rough for a very lengthy period. But also, I think it's very important to draw attention to another aspect of Robert's story. He told that he has now been living in a hostel for 2 years. Now, Robert is clearly very articulate. He has clearly a very, very sound and understanding of his situation over the chronology and what happened and so on. And we have a huge question there to ask. Why is Robert in a hostel for 2 years? The aim of our homeless strategies and policies is to move people out of homelessness at the earliest possible juncture. It's critical because the longer the duration of homelessness, the less likely they are to exit. So we have a problem with private rental accommodation, its availability, with, as Peter mentioned earlier, the rent supplements. We have an additional problem with landlords now refusing to take rent allowance. So we really have a huge problem and discrimination within the system as well. Once landlords realise that people are currently living in a hostel, they don't want to know. And obviously, in any case, people are turning up with cash in hand. There are queues at many of these rental accommodations. So I think we really, if we're really serious about getting young people out of homelessness at the earliest possible juncture, we need to look at the range of affordable housing options currently available and the fact that they're inadequate.
But Peter, is the provision of more houses, more social housing, is that an answer in itself?
Not in itself, but it's the first step in the answer. You can't, I mean, the whole policy now is housing first. Give people accommodation, give them their own home, and then provide the supports. Now, that's a policy that has worked in other countries. It's worked in New York, it's worked in Toronto, it's worked in England in certain parts. It's a policy that works. And we have adopted that policy, but we don't have any accommodation to put them into. And that's where it falls down. So until we provide social housing, I mean, a policy where you want to put people into houses or apartments, and you don't have control of the houses or apartments you're going to put them into, is not a policy, it's a dream, it's an aspiration, it's a hope. And the reliance, the policy of getting people into their own accommodation is relying almost entirely on the private rented sector, and that simply is going backwards, not forwards, because it's become almost impossible now to get into the private rented sector, and it's going to become increasingly impossible, because over the next few years they estimate that 15,000 families' homes are going to be repossessed. Where are they going to go when they leave their home? Into the private rented sector. There we have a huge, huge social housing crisis at the moment, and it's going to explode over the next few years unless we do something about it.
Ciara, I mean, and there's all those empty houses and vacant lots out there. Why aren't they being used?
Well, I think unfortunately, again, it's one of those things where there was lots of houses built in all the wrong places. I mean, there are what we call ghost estates in my own constituency in Waterford, where, you know, we had to draw down money from the local government to board it up and keep it safe. But there's 20, 30 viable houses in behind that wall. I mean, that's just the craziness of what's happened in the last number of years. I think, you know, what's been said in relation to rent allowance, there is a difficulty from talking to my colleagues. It comes up all the time. I mean, we're faced with it all the time in our constituency offices in relation to rental incomes and in relation to rent subsidy. I know that my colleague Kevin Humphreys would talk about how it's really good news that Google and Facebook are coming and setting up in his constituency. But the flip side of that coin is that families from the inner city are being forced out because professionals are able to pay more rent than the people living there. So I think, you know, Janice Sullivan has embarked on the Housing First policy, and money has been put aside, a significant amount. It escapes me now, but I think in the region of 60 million in relation to partnerships with housing organisations to deliver social housing, because I think they're, you know, it's probably not enough, but it's a start, and I believe that that's something that we will continue to advocate and to examine. But again, I'd like just to say that, you know, often in relation to homelessness, I think the point has been made, you know, to try and break the connection in relation to alcohol, in relation to addiction, that we have to look at why family relationships are breaking down, why children are having such poor outcomes in relation to education. And I think until we start addressing the social and emotional needs of children at a very early age and invest significantly in that, I think that kind of an approach in the long term will have a huge dividend for people.
Paula, do you take much hope from the social housing plan and the government's policy in relation to it?
Well, I think that there have been many positive policy developments in the homeless sector generally, and the Housing First one is probably one of the main developments there that I would see as positive developments. What I would say, however, about Housing First is that there's probably the need for a discussion and debate about what Housing First means for young people. Certainly Housing First models have been demonstrated to be very effective for adults, but a lot of these young people around the age of 18 or 19, remember, they have lived very traumatic lives. Many of them are suffering from mental health issues related to those traumas. It may not, certainly for those young people, we're going to need to assess their needs. And a lot of them, if they are moved, if we can find housing, appropriate housing, they will need high levels of floating support. And I'm not talking about a, you know, a SHLE worker going in just you know, once a week. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the need for daily support, help to engage in education, also work with family. It's often perceived or assumed that young people with histories of homelessness don't have connections with family. They desperately want and need connections with their family, and that doesn't mean they should live at home. It means that these connections and re-establishing connections once in housing, and again, these positive developments are far more likely to happen once young people are in housing, are very important and really help them to sustain themselves in housing. And that would be, family support is a big finding emerging from our research, our longitudinal work with homeless young people over a 6-year period, the role, the positive role of family support.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think that's right in relation to the family element to the whole puzzle, that people tend to see homeless people as individuals, you know, just kind of there in existence on their own. But that's not the reality. And I mean, from working within the care system, having worked with as a social worker within the system, you know, there has been a failing in the past to engage with the family once the child even comes into care, because there is an issue that often when a child runs away from a care placement, they run home. And unless we face up to the fact that we need to engage with those parents, those families and those communities, you know, we are going to have the persisting problem of children falling out of the system and, you know, maybe experiencing homelessness. And there has to be an engagement with the parents of the child, even when the child is approaching adulthood, because 9 times out of 10, that child will try to return home. And unless the work is done with the parents to prepare them, and it doesn't necessarily mean they'll go to live at home, but to have a relationship, a meaningful relationship with somebody in their life is so important. And we must invest in that.
Peter, do you get a sense that in 10, 15 years' time, we'll still be talking about how bad the homelessness problem is in this country?
Well, I hope not. But I remember 30 years ago, we were talking about the lack of social care, of special care places for young people. And I read yesterday in the paper, there is a dire shortage today of special care places for young people. These are the most damaged young people in our society. 30 years later, we're still talking about a lack of places for young people. So I would hope we're not still talking about it, but I suspect we might well be.
Well, look, thank you all very much indeed. Well, as we know, this time next week, Christmas will be over. But of course, that won't have stopped many of us fussing and planning and buying like the shops were never going to open again. Our regular contributor, the author and comedian Colm O'Regan, is getting ready for Christmas too.
One of the sad things about growing up, the inexorable passage of time and the accelerating gallop towards the great beyond, is that the years start to blur into one another. The recollection of Christmas's past starts to diminish until eventually one is left with not so much discrete memories, but more a sense of Christmas. Still, a sense is all you need. It's nice to look into the mind's eye for a while, as it takes attention away from checking your phone. What I liked most of all about Christmas was not so much the anticipation of Santa or unwrapping a gift, but the notion that normal household rules were going to be bent a little. The adults were excited, and when adults are excited, they're not as exercised by laws about bedtimes, allocations of chocolates, or watching television at breakfast. The house was a flurry of Christmas activity. All over the place, doors were left open. In a house that wasn't centrally heated, this was usually a sin. But even with drafts wandering freely like looters, draft dodging was suspended around Christmas. And somewhere outside, my father was wrestling with a tree. Over the years, my father planted Sitka spruce and Douglas fir around the place, the fast-growing windbreaker of choice for farmhouses. The tops of these were to form our Christmas trees for many years. We looked out the window into the grove. Branches were shaking as if an elven wind was playing with them. Eventually, my father would emerge triumphant, dragging a Christmas tree after him like a slain caribou. Then he'd drive away an hour later because, obviously, last year's lights no longer worked. Christmas Day peaked around dinner. Turkey, stuffing, sprouts, spuds and turnips crowded the plates, washed down by the old reliable Tanora, a tangerine-flavoured drink that can only be bought south of Clonmel. After dinner, the torpor set in. Everything was off duty on Christmas afternoon, even Airtel. Nothing gave you more of a sense of the otherness of Christmas than the fact that Airtel was also on holidays. Wouldn't it be great if the internet took a holiday for a day? It was also around this time that we realised we'd never get through all the chocolates, and a box of roses was set aside for visiting. It's the gift that never stops giving. You can't be walking into places with one arm as long as the other. cheaper and more numerous than a milk tray, a box of roses is an acceptable way of taking the bare look off your approach to a front door. Even if they were brought to your front door as surplus from another house, don't feel bad. The recipient will do the same. The blue and rosy tin may make its way around the community, perhaps never to be opened, like a metaphor for neighbourliness, a sort of chocolate promissory note. Although it was real, just like Christmas past.
Well, that was Colm O'Regan, and a very happy Christmas to Colm. Peter McVerry, do you like Christmas?
I hate Christmas. It's everybody I know, homeless people and many other families who are living on social welfare or on very low incomes, they tell me they would love to fall asleep on the 1st of December and wake up on the 1st of January. The pressures are enormous. The financial pressures. Imagine a homeless person. Everybody else wearing new clothes on Christmas Day. A homeless person, their self-esteem is already on the floor. And if they have to wear the same old clothes they've been wearing all year on Christmas Day, their self-esteem just goes through the floor. So it's a question of dignity, huge financial pressure on them. Many of them won't go home unless they have a little present to give to their parents or to their brothers and sisters. They'd feel too embarrassed at going home without a present, but they don't have the money to buy a present. So huge financial pressure. It also, for homeless people, is a time when they realise their aloneness very, very acutely. They see, or the perception is, everybody's at home enjoying themselves with their families, and there they are walking the streets because they've nowhere else to go. It's a terrible, terrible time for everybody I know, and I wish we abolished Christmas.
Ciara, is Christmas going to happen for you? Because you have a big event coming up 2 days after Christmas.
That's right, yeah. And I'm getting married on the 27th of December. And, you know, I'd agree with Peter to an extent. I think when you work on frontline services and you experience the difficulties that people have, you know, happy times are great when things are good. But when things are down, happy times can be a very lonely place. I mean, I parented alone, actually, for nearly 11 years. And I'd always explained to people, you know, Holy Communion's, losing her first tooth, taking her first steps, things that parents rejoice in. They were very lonely times for me because I felt somehow that, you know, we were losing out on something. And I hope that this year, and I'm very cognizant that I'm getting married and I'll have a lovely, hopefully, new husband on the 28th of December, that, you know, maybe there's happier times ahead. But, you know, people who have difficult lives, they're never far from my mind. I genuinely mean that. My mom is a psychiatric nurse and always works on Christmas Day to, you know, so it's as a family, we're always very cognizant of that. So, but in saying that, I hope everybody does try as much as they can, including Peter, to enjoy the day.
Well, look, we wish you all the very best in your married life ahead. Paula, what about you? Do you like Christmas?
Well, I do. I do like Christmas. And
thankfully.
I'm one person here who likes Christmas. I think that there are parts I don't like, of course, like the rushing and the pressure on people. You see visibly, you can see it on the street. Obviously, Christmas is a very difficult time for anybody who doesn't have a home or who has a precarious home situation or is experiencing any kind of difficulty. Actually, it could be a family difficulty and so on. Personally, I am looking forward to going home to Mayo, to my parents and my brother and two sisters and my brother-in-law's for Christmas time. So yeah.
You're all set. You're all prepared.
Well, not exactly, but getting there.
Peter, what about you? How will you spend Christmas Day?
Well, I'll be working. One of our hostels will be an open house for some homeless people that we know who have nowhere else to go. So we'll have Christmas dinner there for them. So I'll be based during Christmas Day in that hostel. In the morning, I'll be saying Mass up in Wheatfield Prison, as I do every Sunday. It's a working day for me. Thank God.
And as Robert said at the end of his tape, Ciara, you know, asking people do they like Christmas is not just a question for homeless people. That's a question for everybody. It's reaching in and trying to find that little bit of magic between the child and the grown up.
Absolutely. And I mean, having a child to experience Christmas through their eyes is really wonderful. And I'm really looking forward to it. She was very excited that she landed the lead in the play as Muira. So she was all dressed up, tea towel in hand. And I think when you see that and you experience that firsthand, it just gives you a little ray of hope.
Well, look, thank you all very much indeed. And let me wish you all a very, very happy Christmas. And thank you very much for joining us on this, our last debate, our last late debate of 2013. At this point, let me also say a very big thank you to our listeners throughout the year and an extra special thank you to all our contributors for taking part in our programmes. We literally could not make programmes without you. So on behalf of everyone on Late Debate, have a wonderful Christmas and we'll talk to you again in January.
A late debate special from the Peter McVerry Trust here in Dublin. The presenter was Audrey Carville, the producer Donal O'Herlihy, the researcher was Richie Byrne, and the broadcast assistant was Maeve Mooney.